So I asked Mr. Cameron what he made of Nicola Sturgeon.
Well, obviously, she's having a big impact, and the polls, if you believe them in Scotland, are pretty extraordinary because they show a sort of wipeout of the Labour Party, which has been very dominant in Scotland, you know, for all my political lifetime. But this does have a consequence for the rest of the country, which is what I've been pointing out. I mean, SNP members of Parliament have every right to come to Parliament and vote and speak and act and all the rest of it. But it does concern me that you could have a group of members of Parliament from one part of the country who don't want the rest of the country to succeed. Indeed, they don't want the rest of the country to exist, playing a really big role in the government of the country. And I think that is a big worry.
It certainly doesn't seem to be something worrying a lot of people in Scotland. They are, in fact, throwing their weight behind Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP. Not everybody, but a fair chunk of the population will very, very enthusiastically vote SNP on May the 7th. What is it about her? I mean, you could argue that she's one of the most effective politicians of recent years, certainly probably the most effective female politician since Margaret Thatcher, isn't she?
Well, my view is she's selling a dream, but it's a false dream. She's selling the dream of separation. And I can see there's a nationalist appeal, but I profoundly believe we're so much better off as a United Kingdom, where not only is it the history and the shared endeavour and the things we've done, but also it's the solidarity. When one part of the United Kingdom has a bad time, the rest of us are there to stand in and support. And that, to me, is what the United Kingdom is all about. So I think, you know, sometimes in politics, dreams and visions can be terribly exciting and can enthuse people, but I think I think when you go to the numbers and you actually look at the facts and figures, there are huge holes in her case. Really, with the oil price having come down so far, there's a massive, you know, they'd have to put up taxes, they'd have to cut spending, they'd have to do terrible things if they were independent. So I think this dream will fade, but it's going to take some time, and the parties like mine that believe in the United Kingdom are going to have to fight very hard. Now, fortunately, there's another very strong woman politician in Scotland, Ruth Davidson, who actually the only other party that is going up in Scotland at the moment is the Conservatives.
Yeah.
And she is a force to be reckoned with.
Well, perhaps she is a future leader of the Conservative Party.
Well, indeed. I don't put a limit on her ambition. I think she's extremely effective.
To go back to what you said earlier about dreams and passion, one of your problems, some people would say, is that you are not a dreams and passion person. You yourself, I think, would say you were a pragmatist. You're a practical person. That's what you believe the Conservative Party embodies. But that doesn't translate terribly well. And I think there have been lots of people who've said that your campaign so far, and I appreciate the mood has changed within the last 24 hours, arguably, has been a bit lacking in lustre, no sparkle.
Well, I would argue that the practical things I care about, which is making sure people have got a job, that they can keep more of their own money to spend, that they've got childcare so they can go out to work and build a future for their families, that we build homes that people can buy and own, and that you can have dignity and security in retirement. These may be down-to-earth and practical, but I'm deeply passionate about them, and I think they're the things that matter the most. And yeah, I mean, Conservatives have all, I mean, Ian MacLeod put it so famously when he said, you know, the socialists dream their dreams, the liberals scheme their schemes, but we Conservatives have got work to do. And we are deeply practical people, but what I've tried to demonstrate in the last 48 hours is, don't mistake, just because we're not ideologues, just because we're practical people, don't think we don't care massively about the future of this country, about the families within it, and about the security for people we want to deliver.
Now, Women's Act commissioned a poll right at the start of this year, in fact, and the issue that most women identified as their biggest single concern, be no surprise to you, was the NHS.
Yes.
After that, the cost of living, cost of caring for a family, immigration and education. Now, the King's Fund, which is, many people will know, a think tank specialising in health policy issues, it has just said that your government leaves office, and I'm quoting here, with health services under significant strain and a real risk that patient care will suffer as the NHS heads towards a deficit. Waiting times at their highest levels for a number of years, several key targets missed. That is your legacy
I don't accept that. I mean, my legacy of the last 5 years is that we made a big choice 5 years ago when we knew we had to make spending reductions and efficiencies. We singled out the NHS and said the NHS is special, it will not be cut. And we've increased money into the NHS every year I've been Prime Minister. And as well as the money, we've actually seen the NHS treat millions more patients. We've set up a cancer drugs fund to make sure people get the drugs that they need. We've seen innovative new treatments. Cancer survival rates are on the way up.
So why do the King's Fund say
I mean, they're painting, I think, a very partial picture. And let's just take the issue of waiting times. There are actually fewer people waiting 18 at 26 or 52 weeks for their operation today than when I became Prime Minister. So I don't... Of course, there are pressures on the NHS. We have a growing population of frail elderly people. We need to get the joining up of the health and social care system better. But the health service today is stronger. There are 7,000 more nurses. There are 9,000 more doctors. I set a particular target for health visitors, something of great concern to women when they're coming towards having that baby in the early weeks. And we said 4,000 more health visitors. We've met that target, and the health visitors are providing an amazing service to women in our country.
Will there ever be a time, though, when a politician, and it would be a brave one, actually says, you know what, we cannot go on throwing money into the NHS. It is not... We do not have a bottomless pit to sustain what is becoming a service that too many of us are asking too much
of.
I think
I wouldn't say that. I think, look, our health system, effectively, we all pay an insurance premium through our taxes, and as a result, we get this wonderful thing, which is a free NHS available to all on the basis of need, not ability to pay. I never want to change that, and I believe as our country gets richer and as we have a strong economy, which we have today, we can afford to keep investing in our NHS. And so that's why I'm backing the Simon Stevens NHS plan with the $8 billion extra and the efficiency changes.
You've been asked before, but I'm going to ask again. Yeah. Your $8 billion is coming from where?
It is coming from our public spending plans. Because we're
from
saying...
From cuts?
No, well, because we have a growing economy, we're saying that we're going to make some further reductions in other spending departments, we're going to make some welfare savings, we're going to find $5 billion from tax evasion and tax avoidance, but just as in this Parliament, we've increased spending every year on the NHS, so we'll do so in the next Parliament. The figures are, in the last Parliament, $7 billion more on the NHS over and above inflation. To achieve the Simon Stevens plan, you need a minimum of $8 billion. So I don't think that is an impossible ask.
What about childcare? Your offer is an interesting one. Are you going to double the current 15 hours of free childcare? This is for the over threes, the 3 and 4 year olds before they go to school. But for many women, and let's be honest, we are largely talking about women who take time off to care for small children, the crunch time in terms of getting back into the job market is when the children are rather younger. This is when it's really difficult actually to make ends meet. Childcare costs are prodigious in some parts of the country, absolutely through the roof. The situation is, to say the least, patchy, isn't it? Decent childcare provision remains patchy.
I agree with that. And I think for many families, this is not sort of one issue amongst many that they think about. You sit around the kitchen table and it is the issue, because it's, can I work 3 days a week rather than two? Can I do that extra shift? Can I put that extra money on the table for the family? And the answer in too many cases is I can't, because I can't afford the childcare. So the 3 and 4 year old offer is, I think, very clear. We're building on something that we've already put in place, the 15 hours. So I think doubling it to 30 is good. And obviously at 3 and 4, a lot of people are thinking of going back to work. But I agree with you, helping earlier is important, which is why we also have this plan, and we've legislated for it, so it's coming in, which is effectively tax relief on childcare. So if you spend up to £10,000 on childcare for your child up to the age of 12, all the way from the start, you get £2,000 back. And that £2,000, I think, will make a lot of difference, per child, make a lot of difference to families who are trying to, you know, make that decision of balancing work and family life.
I mean, some people we know from the interaction we have with our listeners, you've got women with 2 or 3 part-time jobs and childcare responsibilities, and possibly, though not always, a partner who's doing much the same thing. These are lives about which I suspect you don't know a great deal. Would you acknowledge that?
I wouldn't. I mean, obviously, I'm very fortunate. I have a well-paid job currently, and I have a wife who works. And so
and
we're
decent
able
childcare.
To, and very, very good childcare. We have fantastic childcare. But I do understand, you know, other people's lives. I have people coming to my surgery, laying out their bills in front of me and saying, right, how do I make this work? I'd like to work more. You'd like me to work more, but I can't find the affordable childcare place. And that's where I think the tax relief is going to be very powerful. Also, for people who choose to stay at home, the married couples allowance we've introduced, where you can transfer some of your tax allowance to a working partner, only for basic rate taxpayers.
I think not much help if you're a single mother or a single parent.
But it does help to give people who are couples, including civil partners, that choice.
Now, what about the cuts? It's been said very regularly that women have borne the brunt of the cuts so far, and you've already said there are going to be more cuts in welfare spending. We know women are more likely to work in the public sector, they're more likely to use public services. The Women's Budget Group, which is an independent organisation, has looked at every single coalition budget and says that so far they've had a disproportionate impact on women, particularly low-income women, single mothers and single female pensioners. What do you say to that?
Well, I think, first of all, it's worth just rewinding and remembering why we had to make savings in the first place. We inherited an appalling budget deficit, a country that was on the brink of bankruptcy, an economy that wasn't growing, far too many people out of work.
But
this is important because we had to make these steps in order to get the economy back on the road to recovery. The result is more women in work than ever
before. And some people would
argue
that it is women who've paid the price for this recovery.
Well, let me answer that very directly. The figures that you quote don't take into account many of the changes that have benefited women, such as freezing the council tax or helping with fuel duty or lifting to £10,600 the amount you can earn before you start paying income tax. We also made some specific choices to try and help low-paid women, for instance, in the public sector. When we did the public sector pay freeze, we exempted the lowest paid who got a pay increase. But look, I'm happy to be judged by the results because I want a genuinely equal society where people feel they can get on and build a good life for themselves and their families. And the facts are there are more women in work than ever before. If we look at the gender pay gap, for the under 40s, it's been virtually eradicated.
Well, in part-time jobs as well as full-time?
Well, so we're making, you know, there's more to do. Most of the jobs now being created are full-time, some 80% of them full-time, not part-time. So we're making good progress. But, you know, the job isn't finished, the job isn't done, and we need to stick to the plan that's delivering.
Well, the Women's Budget Group do say that 66% of women are currently under the current income tax threshold.
Well, that's partly because we keep lifting the income tax
threshold. But it still is an indication of how little they are earning.
What I want to do is, we've got it to £10,600, we want to get it to £12,500, and we've guaranteed that people on minimum wage working 30 hours a week will always be under the income tax threshold. But I want to see genuinely equal pay between men and women in our country. Now, for the under 40s, under this government for the first time, the pay gap has been eradicated. It still is too high for the over 40s. But as you often discuss on this programme, we've got to now go after the causes of that, because it's not so much now companies discriminating, it's because of training, it's because of the availability of apprenticeships, the number of people going to universities, and all of those things are changing. You look at numbers of going to universities now, you're seeing a big increase in female applicants.
The fact is that although jobs have been created, there's no denying it, really, really slow to rise, and taxpayers are still subsidising big business. They are allowing, we are facilitating big business, paying people not very much money, by helping them out.
Well, we're changing that. I mean, first of all...
Well, how are we changing it?
Let me explain. First of all, it's good that the economy has generated 2 million more jobs. There are 2 million more people in work than when I became Prime Minister, and that is good news. Wages are now growing ahead of inflation. But we're dealing with this problem that you rightly highlight by the minimum wage is increasing. It's now getting close to £7. It will get to £8 in the next Parliament, and we should encourage that, and I certainly encourage that. And also, by lifting people out of income tax, we're helping with the cost of living. I mean, the biggest cost of living problem there is the tax you pay at the end of the month on your salary. And, you know, when people say to me, well, Mr. Cameron, you know, you want to make more savings in government spending. Yes, I want to make those savings because the cut I don't want to make is to reach into your pay packet and cut your pay, which is what the other parties would do because they're not prepared to take difficult decisions about public spending.
We have interviewed you on the programme before about the internet,
yes,
and specifically internet porn. Now, last week on the programme, we discussed increasing rates of anxiety and stress amongst young teenage girls. Now, many people have already made the link between that and our incredibly and increasingly sexualised society. We live in a world where it's actually hard to talk about and hard to stomach for many of us, where teenagers will look at images of anal sex on their telephones in the playground. Now, what, if anything, can any government do about this?
Well, I worry about this deeply as a parent of three young children, not yet at teenage age, but getting there. And we've got to do more. The last time I came on your programme, actually, we did have a discussion about whether we could get internet companies to ban revolting search terms. And I think we were both a bit doubtful about the time about whether we could, but actually we have. I mean, Google have banned, not just in Britain, but all over the world, 40,000 search terms. So I use this example as an example to say, look, just because the internet is, you know, a free space, doesn't mean it's ungoverned. You know, the rules that apply.
Well, some would argue it's ungovernable.
Internet, well, I don't. I think what I'm demonstrating is it's not ungovernable. So we've got those revolting search terms blacked out and taken off the internet, something people said was impossible. We've also put onto people's computers default on filters, which you have to switch off. So when you sign up to a new broadband service, that flashes up. But if you're saying, do we need to do more to you know, regulate and to deal with this, yes, we also, as you know, we banned rape porn, banned simulated rape porn. But I think there's still more work to be done.
What about the Greville Janna case, back in the papers again today? Well, the DPP has said that she's happy with her decision. She believes it was the right one. What is your view on this? And what do you say to cynics who are inevitably pouncing on this as an excuse to say, here we are in good old Britain, still the home of the establishment cover-up?
It's very difficult to, as Prime Minister, I have to be very careful what I say. We have independent authorities to police and to prosecute and to take decisions about prosecution. I would agree with everything Theresa May has said about this case, but we have in the end, in a free, rule of law, democratic country, you can't have the Prime Minister pointing the finger and saying, prosecute this one and don't prosecute that one. We have to leave it to the authorities. All I would say is they should feel they can go anywhere, find any evidence, prosecute any person, that there should never be anything covered up or pushed in their way.
Do you think there has been in the past?
I think in the past, and you saw it. I'm not going to talk about Greville Janna because I shouldn't, but I think, you know, it's for them to decide. I'm making a point about the future, and I don't think this would happen again. I think there's now much more understanding that you've just got to go where the evidence is, that no one is too high and mighty not to be investigated. And the idea of police being warned off or prosecutors being warned off, that I really don't believe that will happen in this day and age, and it absolutely mustn't.
Now, prime ministers have to do all sorts of things in their line of work, in their line of duty. And you had to go to Saudi Arabia after the death of King Abdullah to pay your respects. Mm. And this was something that many people found odd. Ruth Davidson, who we mentioned earlier, the Scottish Conservative leader, did ask why the flags were being flown at half-mast. She couldn't get her head around it at all. Can you understand why so many people were puzzled, but perhaps bordering on outraged at the notion that
a
British Prime Minister in the 21st century goes to a country where women have almost no rights at all? Why should we allow that?
I do understand the concern, and I don't agree with the Saudi approach on many of these issues. And when there are cases of human rights abuse, for instance, we raise these with great vigour. The reason for going and the reason for having a relationship, and a relationship that has to be based on mutual respect of each other's systems, is that as Prime Minister, I've got a duty to try and keep Britain and British people safe in the world. And Saudi Arabia has been and is a partner for combating terrorism and for exchanging intelligence and information that has on occasions, and I can think of one specific occasion, when intelligence has actually helped to save lives, potentially on quite a large scale.
Intelligence
here in this
received
country.
From Saudi Arabia.
Yes, because, you know, we have huge differences in our societies. We are a democracy. We believe in freedom and equality and all the rest of it. And Saudi Arabia takes a different approach. It's a deeply religious and theocratic society. But the relationship matters because in the end, we do have a shared interest in stability in the Middle East and preventing terrorism and fighting Al-Qaeda and stopping the radicalisation of young minds that can be turned into terrorism.
Do you think that you suffer as a politician as a result of a sort of inverted snobbery, that people take a pop at you because of where you went to school, who you are, where you've come from?
I don't think I wouldn't say I suffer. Look, I'm very proud of the fact I had loving parents who gave me a great start in life and sent me to amazing school, and you know, gave me every good break as parents want to.
It have been easier if you hadn't gone to that school. Well, I could think of countless other very good schools you could have gone to.
But
you
could only live the life you live. I mean, I did feel for a while that my full name was the Aldertonian David Cameron rather than just David Cameron. But look, I am who I am. I don't try and change the way I speak or alter details about my background. I am you know what I am. But I think in Britain, actually, people, they want to know, you know, what you've got to offer. Are you any good? Can you get things done? Rather than obsessing about where you came from.
And people also judge you as well by your friends. Andy Coulson was your communications director. You also leapt to the defence of Jeremy Clarkson, perhaps rather early in proceedings. Do you regret that?
No, I mean, look, it was absolutely, you know, it's never acceptable to treat people you work with in the way that he did. I obviously don't know all the details of the case, but it's pretty clear what happened was unacceptable. But I'm what I said was, you know, he's a friend and a talent, and I hope that things can be sorted out. Well, they weren't, but I probably ought to leave it at that. I mean, look, he is a neighbour and a friend, and I think you can't in life just.
But that is to a degree what alienates people, isn't it? It's the Chipping Norton thing. It's the chunky corduroy trousers.
I don't have a pair, if that reassures you. But
I suspect you might have a raspberry coloured pair of trousers.
I absolutely
don't.
I can swear there are no red trousers. You can come and inspect my.
Well, that's an offer, right? But you understand why some people feel that this is a world they could never enter in a million years.
But I didn't know Jeremy Clarkson before I became the Member of Parliament in Whitney, and
so he's just another constituent.
Bought a house in a village where he happened to live next door to. That's how I got to know him. But look, what I would say is, if you look at the people I work with, many of them with me here this morning, people who I've worked with for 10 years, as Leader of the Opposition, as Prime Minister, and okay, we make some choices and sometimes don't get things right, but I'm happy the people I work with, the people I spend time with on this incredibly important job and mission that I have, I hope they'd say I give them a fair break.
You have got more female Tory MPs than you did have, but there are still five times as many men as women representing the Conservative Party in Parliament, or there were.
Well, the figures are... I mean, look, first of all, I want a political system where we have genuine equality between men and women. We need more women in Parliament, more
women...
But
we're nowhere near that, are we?
No, absolutely. But the figures for me, I became leader in 2005. There were 17 women MPs. There are now Conservative women MPs. There are now 48. If I look round the cabinet table, leave out the Liberal Democrats because they haven't got any women in the cabinet. But of the Conservatives who sit around the cabinet table, almost a third are women. That is good progress. But I want us to go further. I want us to do more. The good news is in the retirement seats. So I'm sorry to blind you with figures, but I think this is the real test for the party.
So you've got
leader.
Women in winnable seats.
Yes, the ones where not just winnable, but the ones where the Conservative MP is standing down. Those are the real test, because those are the ones that, you know, are real bankers, as it were. One in five almost are British black or minority ethnic candidates, and about 37% are women. So that's good progress. I still want us to go further. But
well, you
I
could
think
win some female votes, but votes, I'll get there in the end, by taking VAT off sanitary products, tampons and towels.
Yes, I would love to. If I could sign the piece of legislation now, I would do it. The problem is that the way the European rules about VAT work is it's almost impossible to introduce new zero rates. So we have a lower rate for sanitary products.
So we can't do it because
Without a change in the way this, and you'd need all 27 other countries to agree, you can't produce a new zero rate. I know they remember with the last government, they wanted to do it very sensibly on repairs to churches. And in the end, they had to produce a fund for to reimburse churches for...
So repairs to churches and tampons, they come under the same category.
Well, no, that wasn't the point. The point I was simply making.
Even though I'm
if
totally
you don't
baffled.
Have a see, some things have a zero rate already. Children's clothes, food. You can maintain your zero rates, and we will. The difficulty is making something else a zero rate. You can't do it under the current rules, and I know people find that maddening. Frankly, well, I find it maddening,
and it won't change. So it won't change.
It is very difficult to change it.
Okay. Will you resign if you don't get a majority?
Well, I'm not going to contemplate anything. I've got, 9 days to go. I'm going to spend those 9 days fighting as hard as I can for the majority that I think is attainable. There are only 23 more seats the Conservatives need to win. That's what I'm going to fight.
The most recent poll was rather good for the Conservatives,
well, we
wasn't
had
it?
Some polls out last night, but they do polls come and polls go, as I've learned during this campaign. But they, we seem to have some momentum, some wind in the sails. I think because the key issue at this election is economic security and stability. And do we stick to the plan and the team that's delivering the jobs and the growth? And do we build on the foundations that we've laid and do what I think is something special for the UK, which is turn good economic news into a good life for people in our country? That's what's on the ballot paper. But so I'm going to spend the next 9 days on that and contemplate other things afterwards.
Very briefly, when it comes to the end, whenever that end is, what is the best an ex-prime minister can hope for? I mean, it's sort of grudging respect, isn't it?
I'll leave that till later. All I know is it is an immense privilege to have this job. This is an amazing country, and to be the prime minister is a huge privilege. And I feel, you know, very fired up, because the last 5 years has been about a turnaround and a recovery for our economy. And I want to spend the next 5 years building on that so that more people get the security of a job, a better pay packet, a school place for their child, a home of their own. That's the British dream. That's what people want to achieve. And that's what I want to help them achieve these next 5 years.